Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Even with the partial federal government shutdown, eligible participants can sign up for the health care plans under the Affordable Care Act exchanges starting today. We will hear from financial planner Kevin McKinley on this edition of On Your Money about who's affected and how this all works. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us, and I hope you will join in with questions you might have on taking advantage of the state exchange. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We will also talk about how to shop around for wristwatches that connect to your smartphone a little bit later in the program. We also will have answers to your personal finance questions, whatever they may be. Joining me now is Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Happy October.
Happy Rocktober back to you.
Yeah. So how is this all going to work? You probably haven't heard anything about it, but October 1st is the first day that eligible participants can sign up for health insurance via the Affordable Care Act. So what do we need to know about signing up?
Well, the first thing we need to know is that we won't be discussing whether this is the greatest thing in the world or the worst thing in the world, nor will we be answering questions about whether your bunion that's been there since 1975 will be covered by the ACA. But we do want to talk about some things about how this might affect you personally, both now and today. The sign-up date does start today. The due date for getting coverage going by the 1st of next year is December 15th, but the enrollment period actually runs through March 31st. If you don't enroll, and you should enroll, you may pay a little bit of a penalty on it for the time being. But 80% of people will probably not be affected and shouldn't be worrying about this today. There will be some immediate effects for it, and there will be some other long-term ramifications, I think.
Yeah, so, but first of all, we'll talk about it later. What is your take on the motivation for this legislation?
I think there are several goals. Trying to get people in for more preventative care, which hopefully is less expensive to nip things in the bud early rather than later in the ER. Also, to spread the cost of health care around. Younger people are probably going to pay a little more and help subsidize policies for older people. Uninsured people hopefully will get insurance so that the hospitals and people who provide care for them when they need it can still get paid for it by the actual patient's insurance policy. And this thing is important for a lot of people, not even so much from the actual standpoint, but a fear standpoint. And that is that it's removing pre-existing conditions barring you from getting health insurance. A lot of us, some of us have those pre-existing conditions. Other people worry about getting those. And it allows them to still get some coverage for it, even if they have something which would normally kick them out of the pool.
What do you see as some of the possible longer-term effects?
I think there will be less ties to the employer because less people will be getting insurance from their employer for better or for worse. I think that will give people more flexibility because you won't be tied to a job just because that's the only place that you can get group health insurance because of a particular condition or because of the cost. And speaking of cost, I think there will be more awareness of the cost and the care of insurance. A lot of people who have been receiving employer-provided health insurance aren't aware how expensive it actually is to the employer because the employee is only paying usually a portion of that. I think we may have less spending and less waste, but possibly less care as well, as has been mentioned before, because many people who do opt in for the lower-cost plans with higher deductibles, they'll be less likely still to go in and get that care because the deductible is going to be so high. But at least those people will have some insurance on which to base coverage.
So where do we go to sign up if we need to?
Well, we'll talk about that later on in the show.
Yeah, when you say that 80% of us don't have to worry about it, so there's a lot of people that don't have to sign up?
Well, it's so they're already going to be covered by some other plan.
Okay. Well, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you do have a question, you can call in now, be it on signing up for these healthcare exchanges, or if it's a personal finance question on another matter, 1-800-642-1234, or send the email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and a listener named Donna says, Kevin, we are 65 years old. We have had this universal life insurance policy for 20 years. It has a cash value of $55,000. The agent has informed us that we have paid premiums of approximately $47,000. If we cash it in, we'll have to pay taxes. To avoid taxes, can we roll it over into a new policy? Recently, we discovered the policy will lapse when we are 76. I guess what this really means is that if we don't do something with the cash value, the insurance company keeps it all. What should we do to receive the most value for our money? That's a quandary.
That is today's personal finance story problem from On Your Money. And the train is leaving the station at
how many donuts?
4 o'clock. Normally, this is a process of evaluation, answering several questions. Do you need the insurance? Can you afford the premiums if there are premiums? Do you have a better use for the money that's either contained in the insurance or that you would be spending on premiums? What kind of return is the policy providing, and how soon will the death benefit be paid? Meaning, if you have a long life expectancy, you probably expect to not receive that death benefit and be paying in for it for quite some time.
So what about Donna's concerns about taxes and the lapsing of the policy?
The tax bill probably won't be much. It's only going to be on the appreciated value over the premiums, and that's assuming they just take a lump sum from it. There are some strategies that can be used to withdraw that cash benefit, sometimes by getting a loan from the policy that can be tax-free. And even if she's worried about the insurance lapsing, all insurance eventually lapses. The longer people live, especially with life insurance, the more likely it is that they'll have to kick in money on top of what any earnings that the policy has if it is a cash value policy. And she can pay in to maintain that coverage. And offhand, I would suggest she would, unless she is in excellent health and has a lot of longevity on her side. But there's actually a bigger concern here from my standpoint.
What do you think the bigger concern is?
It's that the agent is trying to sell them a new policy. It doesn't sound like they need this policy as it is. And some agents, certainly not all of them, look at these cash values accumulating the policy and say, that's a big chunk of money and we could roll that into a new policy and the insurance agent could get a bunch of commission from it. Now, sometimes that's necessary because of the insured standpoint, their predicament or situation could require that they get not only keep insurance but get a new policy for it. Doesn't sound like that's the case here. So what I'd prefer that people in this situation do is get an independent analysis of the policy. And as we mentioned a few weeks ago, the Consumer Federation of America, for about $50, will give you a pretty thorough analysis of the policy, tell you about its internal rate of return, if it's worth keeping, if it's competitive with other policies. And that's true with both new policies and existing ones. And then there are a couple other people around the country who are independent insurance analysts. Peter Cott is one in Michigan, and a guy named Glenn Daly is one in New York. Now, they'll provide these kinds of independent analyses themselves. They'll be more sophisticated, but they'll also be more expensive. And we'll have links up to those three different websites, the Consumer Federation and those two independent consultants, up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
If you would like Kevin to answer a question in a future email bag segment, you can send an email with your story problem to onyourmoney@wpr.org. onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also call us right now if there is a money matter on your mind. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Katie emails, my daughter is 17 and has a part-time job. What advice can you give to her for saving and investing for her college years? How about that, Kevin?
I like that one a lot. She's one of the rare teenagers who actually has a job right now. The unemployment rate for teenagers in America is approaching 50%. A couple things about this. First of all, if my biggest point of excitement for her is to actually have her use the proceeds of that job to contribute to a Roth IRA. And she can do it herself, the daughter can, or someone else can do it for her, and the daughter can actually keep the proceeds from her from the job. Once she gets that money into that account, it can be pulled back out at any time. There are no taxes or penalties, the contribution portion anyway. And if she were to keep it in her own name, like in a savings account, let's say, with her own Social Security number, it may preclude her from getting need-based financial aid, that if the money were in the Roth IRA instead, it generally isn't counted into the formula that schools use for financial aid. And the second thing about it is that I would say I'd really love to see someone at 17 start developing some kind of spending and tracking plan so she knows where her paycheck is going and has an idea of where it is so she can kind of modify it. And more importantly, when she gets out on her own at school and as an adult, that can provide the great foundation for what I think is the most important factor in determining financial independence and achieving it, and that is how much you spend in a given month.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, here with information and advice on your money. We'll take more of your questions about personal finances in just a few moments. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Here to answer your questions about your personal finances at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our first caller is Ken in Delafield. Hello, Ken.
Hello. My question is, I just recently retired. I'm 63 and a half. I am on a pension right now at around $1,900 a month before taxes. I sold a piece of property which I got around $10,000, and I'll put in for my Social Security when I'm 64 in February. I have approximately or a little over $300 in a 401k. Half of that is about money market, and the other half is very, very low risk growth. My question is should I have the entire thing into a growth to help keep up with inflation? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, then I'll give my answer off the air. Ken, congratulations. And this is a common question for people in your situation, and there are several reasons I would say the answer is no. The first one is that inflation is really not as big a bugaboo for people as we perceive, in part because inflation is more prevalent in things that we buy every day, like food. And we see a lot of it in food and at the grocery store. But it's not as prevalent in other things that we pay for. Now, there is healthcare, but the cost of that is going up, but it also is the technology and the efficiency of the actual healthcare provided, even though we're spending a lot more of it. So I'm worried more at this situation, Ken, about hanging on to what you have than I am about preserving your purchasing power, because stocks are near an all-time high, bonds are near all-time high in prices, meaning interest rates are near all-time lows. You already have a pension, $1,900 a month, that's about $22,000 a year or so. And I'm guessing a good chunk of that pension is already invested in stocks and bonds over which you have no control and no knowledge over where it's invested. And that is something that is probably invested and designed to keep up with inflation, as it were. Social Security is going to be another big chunk of income for you. And that is also going to be adjusted upward, hopefully, for inflation. Not significantly, maybe 1% or 2% a year, but that will help you keep inflation. So I would keep up with inflation. So I'd rather have someone in your situation err on the side of caution with this money, and even look at things like CDs for it. And the biggest reason I would say this, other than all the other ones, is that it's a very difficult time to transition from working and saving to retiring and spending. And you're trying to do that, Ken, at a time when we're in the biggest, most volatile financial abyss that we've faced in our lifetimes. And people talk about it being a great situation. Oh, I can't wait to retire. I can't wait to retire. But still, for most people, it's very hard to do that. And one of the worst things that could happen to you, both emotionally, psychologically, and financially, for that matter, is to have it invested too aggressively, and it drops 20 or 30% just when your paycheck stops. So again, at this point in your life, asset prices are high, you're just transitioning, and you have little control over the rest of your assets, I would rather have you err on the side of caution.
Thanks very much for the call. We'll go next to Mike in Appleton. Hello, Mike. Mike, are you there? Well, I guess we don't have Mike on the line, so we'll go to a different caller. And that is Marilyn in Stevens Point. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi. I'm an elderly widow with quite a bit of money and all invested in about 6 CDs, some of them worth about $100,000. I was afraid to go over $100,000 because at one time there was a rumor that the over $100,000 bit would be taxable. What should I do with all of that? Three inheritors out of state.
Sure, Marilyn. Do you need that money for something, or are you just kind of keeping it safe just in case?
No. I'm okay with it. My checking account probably is too large. And I had taken all the money out of the stock market at a wonderful time. Because
good for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, is this okay? Is it stupid to have all those CDs with the money in it?
Absolutely not. I, without knowing a lot more about your situation, offhand, I would say it's very smart to leave that where it is. The insurance limits have gone up. They've been bumped up to $250,000 per person,
yeah,
per institution. But some people say, you know what, I'm just to kind of keep things a little safer, I'm not going to push that unless there's an extraordinary circumstance. So I'd rather have you just keep it in CDs that you feel safe with. You maybe want to go out a little longer in the maturity, noting what the surrender charge is if you pull the money out early, because typically you will, of course, get a little higher yield if you go out 4 or 5 years. And often, especially at local banks and credit unions, the surrender charge is fairly small. It might be 6 months or maybe a year's worth of interest, which,
yeah,
by nature of the interest being very low, isn't that big of a penalty. So, no, I like CDs. I think, again, you should concentrate more on hanging on to what you have rather than sticking your neck out too far for really no apparent reason. You don't need growth at this point, and therefore you don't have to take on a lot of risk.
No, and then they all have POAs and PODs legally.
Good for you.
So it's okay then, huh?
You have my blessing, Marilyn.
Thanks a lot. I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Oh, she went with the post question,
yeah,
praise. That was an interesting gambit.
Yeah, you get post-mortem points on that one, Marilyn. Next time, even a better answer. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question for Kevin. We'll go next to Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. Good morning to you and Kevin. I've got, at the present time, I've got a little over $5,000, which isn't much in this day and age. And regular savings accounts don't draw much. Now, listen to what you're like. You said you like CDs. Would it be a good idea to turn that into a CD? I was wondering what to do with it.
Well, Eugene, that's a great question, and my opinion on what's a lot of money is if it's a lot, mm-hmm, of money to you, it's a lot of money. And whether that's $5 or $5 million, if it's a lot of money to you, it's a lot of money. And so I do like CDs for it. if you really want to go kind of outside the box but keep it safe, I would look at those Series I savings bonds, but they're kind of tricky. You have to sign up online, and I've had a person, head of an IT department at a university, call me and say, yeah, I tried to get online to buy those CDs, and I gave up, or those savings bonds, I gave up after a while because the Treasury's website is so confusing. But you can go to savingsbonds.gov and look at the Series I savings bonds. Those will give you a little bit higher yield, lots of safety, no state taxes on the interest, and after 5 years of keeping it in there, there's no penalty. If you take it out before 5 years, it's just 3 months' worth of interest. Otherwise, go shop around your local banks or credit unions, see what they're offering, and you might see rates a little higher in the next few months anyway. If you can get close to 2% on that and keep it within 5 years, you're getting a pretty good deal.
Thanks, Eugene. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question about your personal finances that you would like Kevin to tackle. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And we have an email from Steve who writes, for the past many months, my 401k previous year returns have been in the 20 to 25% range. I have my provider distribute purchases via their pre-configured maximum growth model with quarterly scheduled rebalancing. Boy, that's a mouthful. I am concerned that these returns are too good to last, and I'm wondering if it's likely to be in my interest to harvest more gains than the rebalancer would at these highs, or don't touch anything and hope the trend continues. Did you understand that, Kevin?
I actually did, sadly. I can't remember my own birthday, but I did understand that question. And at a time, as we've discussed, with asset prices near all-time highs, and I don't doubt those returns, especially if it was very aggressively invested. But the question becomes not so much what to do at this point, but how much of a slide that he can tolerate on the way back. And all you have to do is go back 5 years now, or 10 years, or 15 years, or even 25 years, and find a time when stocks fell 30 or 40%. And that would not shock me if that were to happen again. I hope it doesn't, but it definitely can and probably will at some point. And so what he should do is go into his portfolio and shave off 40% of the assets and see how that makes him feel. And if he can stand that, then he can probably go along with the ride and even the rebalancing. But if not, he may want to go more conservative for it, because a lot of people don't understand that most of us didn't have any money in 1983 when the Dow Jones Industrial Average was at about 800. And as it marched up to almost 16,000 over 30 years, we've become accustomed to the fact that the worst thing you can do with your investments usually is to sell your stocks, because eventually it comes back and goes up even further. But what a lot of people don't realize, and I do because I have a economics and history major from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, the goodest college in the Big Ten, one of the things that I studied was longer-term trends of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And I learned that in 1966, the Dow hit about 1,000. And as I mentioned, 17 years later in 1983, it was at about 800 or so. So for 17 years, people made no money on their stocks generally, even with the dividends in there. And at the time, interest rates, of course, were rising quite a bit, and people were more interested in using fixed income investments. So it's hard to say for sure. Asset allocation is a very tricky thing. But if you run through kind of a what if or a fire drill on your portfolio and say, if it were to fall 40 to 50%, how would I feel? If you can handle that, then fine, stay along for the ride. But if not, shave it back, and again, even more so than the rebalancing program might already do for you.
Let's take another call from David. I think David's in Milton. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I have a question. I have two aging parents. My dad is looking at getting out of his fourth retirement due to a shoulder surgery, and I'm wondering how we can give him some money so he doesn't have to go back to work at over 70 plus as a teacher. So I'm wondering about, like, reverse mortgages.
And we lost David in Milltown. So he wants to know if he should look into reverse mortgages for his aging parents.
Right. I think that reverse mortgages, while you must tread cautiously and try not to, get the one that Fred Thompson is selling online, or maybe use that, or on TV in the infomercials, as maybe use that as the last resort. But they are a tool, and a tool can be dangerous and a tool can be valuable depending on the user and the circumstances. So I think reverse mortgages should be used in a situation where you are able to stay in the home and you want to stay in the home, but you are not able to get a traditional, say, home equity line of credit, nor a traditional mortgage. And you really don't care if at some point in your life, when you don't need it, the house will not be yours anymore. The dangers of reverse mortgages are that once you apply for it and you get the money you have borrowed starts accumulating with interest, and it probably is going to accumulate at a faster rate than your house will appreciate. So the longer that goes on, the more likely it is that the reverse mortgage balance will be larger than the home is actually worth. Now, again, reverse mortgage borrowers do not have to repay that loan. But what happens is when they get out of their house, either they pass away or they move to a assisted living or nursing home or something, the bank checks the situation with the home, and if there are no spouses still living there, they will sell the home, get what it's worth. If they sell it for more than the reverse mortgage balance, the original borrower or his or her heirs will get the remaining amount. But if they sell it for less than what is owed, then nobody gets anything, and quite frankly, the bank is out the money too.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. And this is On Your Money. It's time now for Smart Assets. And as we mentioned earlier, October 1st is the first day that the Affordable Care Act kicks in, and many of the exchanges are rolling out, going live today, Kevin.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, you may not be affected, at least right now. About 80% of Americans either have a plan at work that they're covered by, an insurance plan, or they're in the military, or they're retired with Medicare, or they have Medicaid, or they're part of the VA system. For the rest, you have a choice now. You have to either buy or qualify for Medicaid or pay a penalty.
And how bad is the penalty?
It's not too severe yet, about $95, and that is going to escalate up to $695 by about 2016. It's a gradual penalty that will be applied to anyone who can't prove that they were covered by insurance. And they think that maybe 6 million people or so in the country will probably not apply for the care or not know enough about it or just choose not to, and so they may be subject to that penalty eventually. But what they're doing is they're actually going to garner tax refunds so that if you can't submit paperwork with your tax return to show that you have insurance coverage and you're owed a refund from your taxes, from your tax returns, they'll garnish that the amount of the penalty. But there aren't any liens placed on you or anything. There's no criminal penalty or anything like that.
So what are shoppers going to find on the health exchanges?
I think they're going to find more comprehensive care. As we mentioned, the older people will find that insurance is actually more affordable than what it might have been a year ago at this time because, again, it's subsidized by some of the younger policyholders and more preventative services. However, you might not have in many of these different plans your in-network provider. So you might see a plan available to you that fits and works, but you might have to choose a different physician if you can't find one that includes your current one. You might pay a little more than you're currently paying or less than what you previously would have paid, depending on the plan that you choose and depending on your individual circumstances.
How are the plans categorized?
There are four levels, and they are bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And really, these levels are based on how much you pay either in terms of premiums or how much you pay out of pocket down the road. The bronze ones are the cheapest ones in terms of premiums, but you can also expect to pay more out of pocket down the road. And then as you go up through silver, gold, and platinum, the premiums will generally be higher. But if you do need care, you will receive more of that without having to pay more money out of pocket. So generally, the more money that you have, the higher up you should probably go on the platinum program. But if you can only afford the basic level of premiums, like the bronze level, you are going to get some tax credits that may help offset the cost. Plus, you may want to put some savings aside to make sure that you are going to be able to cover the out-of-pocket expenses that you might incur.
So any advice for those who are going to start to shop today?
definitely take your time. There is no hurry. Things are going to be jammed right now. Even some of the websites are delayed because so many people are logging on right now. The government site you want to go to is healthcare.gov. And again, I checked it this morning. It's already busy and you probably won't be able to get into it. Consumer Reports has a really nice tool that's free and helpful to people who want to navigate this and get kind of a second opinion from it. It's healthlawhelper.org, healthlawhelper.org. Watch out for scams via the mail, people calling you or sending you an email saying, hey, you need to be on the insurance or there's a penalty or whatever. Go to these other websites first before you respond to any letters or any notes that you get from anybody, no matter how official it looks. And then keep in mind, if you are eligible for this and you do have to sign up for health insurance, you have until March 31st of next year. So you've got 6 months technically before you have to sign up for this. And worst of all, get ready to do the whole thing again next year at this time. And the window for sign up next year will be much narrower. If you want care by the first of the year, you'll have to sign up between October 15th and December 7th of 2014 for next year's plan.
Thanks. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. We do, by the way, have a link to healthcare.gov on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page as well. We'll take more of your questions for Kevin, personal finance questions, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Sarah in Wautoma next. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I'm self-employed. The bulk of my savings is in mutual funds, both in terms of regular savings, IRAs, and Roth IRA. And I'm wondering if this is the best way to go first off. And then it seems to me, I have them all basically through one bank, and it seems to me this particular bank is switching bond ownership, or I don't know, fund ownership fairly frequently so that I'm constantly getting fees attached to the switches. I'm wondering if this is the best way to go and if there's something else I should be doing.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to go. It's interesting that you bring that up. Most people would say, well, hey, look, just because the bank is switching names doesn't necessarily mean you start incurring fees. You're not paying for that. Actually, you probably are. And the reason being is that when one bank acquires another one, they usually have to pay for it. And when they have to pay for it, they have to put up their own money and they hope to generate money back from buying the bank. And a lot of times they do that by looking at the old bank and say you're not charging enough fees and you could be charging more to help garner more income. And that's where some of those fees come from. The other thing is that banks in a very low interest rate environment, much like savers, have a very difficult time making money on their money. And so they're using fees to try to pick it up. You can look for some different online banks if you'd like. You can look for to try to consolidate some of these accounts that you have and get them with one provider, because then oftentimes they'll waive a lot of fees if the account balances are more than a certain amount. But next week we're actually going to be talking about some ways that you can decide if your current bank or credit union is giving you a fair deal, and if not, how to look for a new one.
Thanks, Sarah. Good luck. And we go to Bush in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Kevin, my question is very related to the last person that just called. I've been with my bank for probably 55 years, and they've changed hands 1, 2, 3 times, and I'm looking to find a new bank, a smaller bank, I think. And my question to you is, what question should I be asking my new would-be bank as far as that would help me to find a way to find a better bank or one that's more reasonable?
I would ask them about your situation and say, here's what I'm looking to accomplish and where I'm at in life. And if I were to transfer my assets to you, what services would you provide and what fees can I expect to pay? Keep in mind, that answer may be true and impermanent, meaning that in 6 months or a year, they could get bought or they could change their own policies enough where they would have to start instituting fees like that as well. So you always have to keep on the lookout for it. Have you considered a credit union, Bush?
No, I have not.
Okay. That's one way I would definitely at least take a look at. Credit unions generally have more consumer-friendly policies on both fees and in terms of interest rates and in terms of expenses. They're still, you know, they're trying to make more money than they spend on their operations. But oftentimes, because it's technically a nonprofit, if you will, you can find them a little more amenable to your situation. So again, tune in next week and we'll talk about how to find a good credit union in your area.
Good luck to you, Bush. We will talk more about how to shop around for a wristwatch that you can connect to your smartphone. That's coming up next during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you'd like to join in with a personal finance question, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
My mama told me you better shop around.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Time now for our Shop Around segment. Generations of Dick Tracy fans grew up with the idea that a two-way wrist radio would be an ubiquitous part of their futures. Were those ever something that you could ever buy, Kevin?
I think they were on the back of the cereal box. You had to actually cut it out yourself. Yeah. And don't do it while there's still cereal in the box. Your mom would get mad.
Well, what about these two-way wrist radios?
It never really came true until now. It's basically a small computer that you would wear on your wrist, and as a part of the wearable market, which according to the Gartner Group, wearable electronics, and this would also include the Google glasses and, you know, some of those health monitors you might wear, or your shoes communicate for some reason with your iPod or whatever. It's going to be a $10 billion market in just 3 years, according to the Gartner Group. But many major manufacturers have already come out with these new models of these wristwatches that you can use to tie into your smartphone.
So how do these work?
There is a wireless connection, and you have to have your smartphone on you or very nearby, so they usually don't work independently. But this way you at least get to keep the smartphone tucked away, whether for safety reasons or you just don't have access to it. And it sends some data back and forth between the phone and the wristwatch, or you can use some tools within the watch itself and receive notifications. Like, let's say you've got an email or a text or a Twitter update or a Facebook mention or something like that. Certain wristwatches will alert you that this very important thing has happened.
So do you think there are any promising versions out there so far?
Samsung has one. It's called the Galaxy Gear. It goes for about $300, and you can actually take and make calls with this one and also take a camera shot with it, either a regular still photo or a video. But it only works right now with the Samsung Galaxy Note and tablet. So if you don't own one of those phones or tablets already, it's useless to you for the time being.
Any others of interest?
Sony is releasing a model called the Smartwatch 2, which of course implies that it's better than the Smartwatch 1, which you actually couldn't see in the daylight, which why they didn't think of that before they released the Smartwatch 1, I'm not really sure. Also, there was a Kickstarter project for one called the Pebble, which was successful and is now going to be selling for about $150 each. That basically is a simpler model. It does provide notifications for emails as its basic tool. The interesting thing about this is one of the names that's absent here is Apple. Apple has not come out with something like this yet, and I think this is probably going to be their next big announcement if and when it ever does come out. There's only one smartwatch that really works well with the Apple, and that's called the Cuckoo, C-O-O-K-O-O. Cost a few hundred dollars as well. That's also coming out in October. And of course, if you really want to have something that is a really fully functional smartwatch, all you have to do is just take some duct tape and tape your smartphone to your wrist. And then that has all the functions of your smartphone, but you can still technically call it a smartwatch.
I thought my husband was the only person who still wears a old-fashioned wristwatch. But
does he have the calculator buttons on it, too?
No, he does not.
No, okay, good to know. Good to know.
Let's take some more calls. Char in Appleton. Hi, Char, you're on the air.
Good morning. What a great show. My question is, I have children 5 and 9, and I would like to start saving some money for them for college, and I'm not sure what to do. I've heard of 529 programs, but I don't know if you can lose your money in there or if you keep your money, or is there a better way to do it?
Yeah, the 529 programs are kind of like 401ks for saving for college, or maybe more a more apt comparison is a Roth IRA. And in that, it's kind of a jar, and there are several different investment options within the jar from which to choose. And it can be very safe ones like a CD or a stable value account, or more aggressive ones like a growth-based mutual fund. And the good and the bad news about that, of course, is like all of them, more risk equals more reward. And so you can definitely lose money on it. If you choose the safe options for it, you don't make very much money on it. You might make 1% a year on it, but the chances of loss are much less likely. And even if you do lose money on it, the loss should be very small. The nice thing about the 529 plans, Char, is that it allows you to keep total control over the money. So if someone sets one up for a kid or a grandkid or anybody else for that matter, and for whatever reason down the road, they do not want to pass that money on to the kid or the grandkid or anybody else, they don't have to. They can take the money out, pay a small penalty in taxes on the earnings, and do with it what they please, or they can transfer it in its current state to another individual, and as long as it's a qualified transfer, there are no taxes on it, and then you can start all over again. You can look for Wisconsin's plan at edvest.com and get more information on 529 plans in general at collegesavings.org or savingforcollege.com.
Thanks for the call, Char. Good luck. Melissa in Melrose is with us now. Hello, Melissa.
Good morning. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks for calling.
I am the only person who hasn't refinanced her mortgage during all this hoopla situation. I was unemployed for 2 years. I had good credit, no job. They wouldn't refinance me. Finally got a job. My credit was kind of in the dumpers. Talked to my banker in March. He said, let's wait till October. Your credit should be where we need it to be. My credit has only jumped 5 points in 6 months. Mm-hmm. I paid off all my collections, got the credit card down, yada, 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 everything paid. But I have a thing with the IRS. They say I owe 09 taxes. Would that be affecting my credit to keep it from going up that much?
It may if they have some kind of lien on it. Have you looked at the raw data from your credit score? You're talking about your credit score has only gone up 5 points, but there's some backup data, the actual numbers and accounts. Have you looked at those figures and the status of those yet?
I have not. The banker has. He okay. doesn't understand why the score has only gone up 5 points when I have done everything we talked about to make it better.
Okay. I would do this, Melissa. I would do two things. First of all, I would check the information yourself. And there are three different places you can go. One is you can go to annualcreditreport.com to get the raw data. And you get one free report per bureau per year. There are three big bureaus. And you get one free report per year, annualcreditreport.com. And then if you want to pay a little bit of money and get a really good report on not only your score, but also the raw data behind it that's affecting the score and some tools to see what you can do to improve your score, whether it's paying off some loans or not using a card or whatever, go to myfico.com. But if you don't feel like paying that fee, and it's about probably $20 or so right now, if you don't feel like paying that fee, there's an ad-supported place called creditkarma.com. Creditkarma.com that you log in, you create an account, it's safe and secure, and they'll show you what your score is, and they'll also show you some ways that you might be able to approve it. And the way that they pay for their service is by giving you ads and say, hey, if you switched your account over to this credit card, you might be able to lower your interest rate by 10% or something like that. So go to those three places. And then finally, go to another lender. And sometimes different lenders are in different situations. Try, if you're at a bank, go to a credit union. If you're at a credit union, go to a bank and see what they say about your situation compared to what your current banker does. Sometimes, you know, your current lender's hands are tied basically by not only your situation, but the lender's situation. They might be saying, look, we can't, you know, take on these kinds of loans right now. Other places might be having a sale on their loans and might be more open to dealing with someone in your situation.
Thank you so much, Kevin. I appreciate everything.
Good luck, Melissa.
Yes, thanks, Melissa. Our next caller is Lawrence in Marathon City. Hello, Lawrence.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. In June, my wife became eligible to put money into an HSA. And we plan in January to make a one-time distribution from a Roth IRA into that HSA. We would like to make a large enough distribution so that it takes care of the 2013 contribution and the 2014 contribution. Can we do that?
The question for me, Lawrence, is not if you can; it's if you should. Do you have other assets from which you can draw that money to pay for the HSA, or is that really the only place you can get it from?
There's only about $3,000 in that Roth IRA, and by doing that, we will lower our tax burden in this year.
Right, but I'm saying, do you have like another checking account or savings account or any other assets other than that Roth IRA that you could use to fund the HSA?
It's tied up in investments.
Okay.
This is the easiest way to do it.
Okay.
And I think, personally, I think it's financially the best way to do it, but can we make that distribution into two different years?
No, it's only a one-time distribution that you can do it. You get basically a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And without knowing more about your situation, Lawrence, I would highly suggest that you look at some other place to get that money from, because what will happen is, yes, you'll get the tax break on the HSA now, but when you pull the money out, if you don't pull it out for qualified expenses before retirement, it becomes an IRA, which then becomes technically taxable. Now, most people don't pay a ton of taxes on their IRAs if they pull them out, but I'd much rather have you look at other sources of funds to fund that HSA rather than tapping the IRA or the Roth IRA for that matter. And again, even if you do it, you only get one shot to do it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime exemption.
Distribution in January, it cannot be split at that time.
Correct.
Into 2 years. Okay, well, that changes it.
Another dissatisfied caller.
Lawrence, thanks very much. We'll try to get one more call in. Katie in Green Bay. Hi, Katie.
Good morning. I am calling with a question on how to better invest the money that we have in our savings account. We are just starting a family. We invest in our employer 401ks. We have a sizable amount in our savings and checking accounts, and I'm just looking for a way to invest that I plan to use the EdVest program to invest for our young child. But any suggestions on what we can do to better invest this money that we have readily available?
Sure. Katie, are you maxing out your contributions to your pre-tax retirement plans at work?
Yes.
Okay, good for you. Are you maxing out any Roth IRA contributions for you and your, I assume, husband?
No. The way I understand it is we can, I believe it's $17,500 that we can put in, and that's what we have put into the post or the pre-tax 401k.
Right. You may also be eligible for a Roth IRA, and I would highly suggest that you use any extra funds to do that, too. Not everyone is, and if your income's too high, you might not be eligible for it. But you can open up Roth IRAs on your own, and if you're under 50, you can contribute up to $5,500 each per year. The third thing I would do is look at spending some money on life insurance. I assume you don't have very much, if any, life insurance in place right now, right?
I have life insurance, and we're working on my husband.
Okay. If you don't mind me asking, how much life insurance do you have on yourself?
I did $500,000.
That's pretty good, and that's surprising. Most people say, "Oh, well, I'm only going to get $100,000." That seems like a lot of money, but most families spend that in about 2 years, and so I would like you to have at least $500,000 on yourself and a commensurate amount. Did you get a term policy on you?
Yes, we did a 20-year.
Oh, good for you. That's also good. I would even have gone longer with a 25 or 30-year, and you might want to do that for your husband as well. So that's a good place to go. But other than that, I think you're doing the right things for it. Just keep that in the savings account.
Great. Good luck, Katie. Just time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Connie says, what's that website you mentioned where a lot of scholarships can be found that otherwise go unneeded? That's fastweb.com. Fastweb.com. We'll have that up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Great. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, with us each week at this time for information and advice on your money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.